Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Long Game, How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World, by Dory Clark. Narrated by Dory Clark. Introduction. I bolted out of bed at the sound, sharp, insistent. It was still dark, and I was disoriented. What was happening in the middle of the night? And then I remembered. It was 3:30 a.m., and the piercing sound was my alarm. I'd said it the night before, because I had a 5 a.m. flight to catch at JFK. Downing 2 aspirin, I already had a headache. I tossed on the clothes I'd laid out on the dresser and summoned my Uber. Heading over the deserted Brooklyn Bridge, I stared at the hundreds of office building lights, left blazing all night, that twinkled against the lapping East River below. I had a mission to accomplish. All I needed to do was force my body to comply. I could rest a little on the plane, then prep for my day of meetings in Los Angeles. I'd arrive at the client by 9:30 a.m. Pacific and sit in on meetings until 6 p.m., 9 p.m. back home, followed by a quick dinner before bed. The next day, I'd have more meetings in L.A., capped by a flight to Atlanta, arriving at 5:50 p.m. Eastern. If weather and traffic held, I'd have just enough time to reach my client dinner meeting and then give a keynote talk the next morning. I knew I could do it all. I had to. And that week, it all went off without a hitch. But speeding across the Brooklyn Bridge, I felt a quick, sharp stab. For just a moment, before I could tamp it down, it felt like loneliness. For just a moment, I wondered why I decided my life should be this way. Around that time, I was teaching a business school executive education program. A large financial services firm had brought in 30 of its top performers for a special 2-day session. These men and women were some of the most successful people at the company, but when I chatted with them after the workshop, they had a common refrain. I just wish I had time to think. It was something I've been hearing a lot lately, even from the people closest to me. My best friend owed me a response to a document I'd sent over. She was usually prompt and thorough, but lately, not so much. It's a quick read when you get a chance to take a breath, I texted her, by way of encouragement. Taking a breath is the issue, she wrote back from her out-of-state business trip. By all outside measures, she was doing great, with a thriving business and a new relationship. But inside, she felt she was barely keeping up. So many of us today feel rushed, overwhelmed, and perennially behind. We keep our heads down, always focused on the next thing. We're stuck in permanent execution mode, without a moment to take stock or ask questions about what we really want from life. Flicking through our friends' and colleagues' social media feeds in spare moments, we're taunted by a parade of triumphs. What's their secret? What do they know that I don't? Why aren't I keeping up? Isn't there a life hack out there that can help? It's no way for any of us to live. What would it look like to set aside comparison, discover our own definition of success, and live life on our own terms? The patient strategy and consistent effort required to get there may seem like lost art forms, but to create the kind of interesting, meaningful lives that we all seek, they're essential, and it's time to embrace them. On February 28th, 2020, my email pinged. I'm delighted to report that we would love to publish the book, my editor wrote. The long game was on. The very next day, March 1st, 2020, the first case of COVID-19 was diagnosed in New York City, where I live. During the early days of lockdown, a colleague messaged me about my book project. I had set out to write about the importance of being a long-term thinker in a short-term world. But in light of COVID, he wondered, wasn't long-term thinking a little passé? The real issue, he said, was what's likely to change unexpectedly and bite any long-term thinking in the ass? I'd been focused on combating the destructive lure of short-term thinking, but now, in the midst of a pandemic where everything changed overnight, the question flipped. Was long-term thinking even relevant anymore? As New York City hospitals overflowed during those early months, the health risks of COVID were terrifying. So were the financial implications. My spring travel plans had been set for months, teaching in Moscow, plus keynote talks in Dallas, Vancouver, Florida, and more. Those trips, and the income they would have generated, were completely vaporized. But then I realized, I knew what to do. My speaking business began in 2013 with the launch of my first book, Reinventing You. Keynote speaking is lucrative and can be glamorous. Talks have brought me around the globe. And yet, I knew it wasn't always going to be sustainable. I knew it when I embarked on a 3-city speaking tour of Slovakia, muscling through despite a hacking cough and laryngitis. I knew it when I taught 6 hours a day for 2 weeks at a business school in Kazakhstan, despite a high fever and chills. When a client has brought you so far, the show must go on, and I always delivered. But I also knew that one day, if I ever got really sick, it might not happen. I had friends, only in their 30s, diagnosed with immune system disorders or cancer. God forbid, I thought, but it made me want to plan. The secret, I knew, was to find a way to earn money that didn't depend on my physical presence, to stop trading time for dollars. So in 2014, I started experimenting with online courses. Working with an established company, I created my first course that year, and I partnered with a different company in 2015 to create a second. I was experimenting, learning. Finally, in 2016, I decided to go all in. I'd independently create my own online course, and to ensure I did it the right way, I'd write a book about the process of carving out new revenue streams, interviewing the world's experts along the way. It was an immersive research project and became my book Entrepreneurial You, released in 2017. I certainly didn't see a pandemic coming. That's not why I started investigating how to develop side gigs and multiple sources of revenue. I was a lot more concerned about the prosaic, falling ill, or perhaps just getting tired of life on the road. The truth is, none of us can predict the future, but we can certainly identify goals we want to head toward or potential vulnerabilities we want to avoid. In the 2 months after COVID hit, I turned up the volume on projects and relationships I'd been developing over the prior 6 years. I wrote the scripts for and filmed 3 new online courses and led a large-scale relaunch of my own online course, Recognized Expert. Those efforts, thankfully, enabled me to turn what could have been a disastrous year for my business into its most successful to date. Doubling down on online courses may have been a short-term move, but it wasn't born of short-term thinking. None of what I accomplished would have been possible without the strategic pivot toward digital education I'd been executing for more than half a decade. Long-term thinking protects us during downturns of all kinds because it keeps us moving toward our most important goals. We need to be nimble and adapt when circumstances change. But long-term thinking is what undergirds everything and enables us to make those adjustments. If all we do is bumble along, reacting to stimuli, we won't be anywhere near our goals. But if instead we embrace long-term strategy and recognize that the path may change over time, that's what maximizes our chances of success. Long-term thinking isn't dead, I realized. Not by a long shot. Taking the long view also has an unusual side effect. Courage. My friend Martin Lindstrom is a top branding consultant and advises one of the world's royal families. The monarch pulled him aside during one visit. "Mr. Lindstrom," he said, "don't be short-sighted. I want you to think in the long term." "How long?" "We're not interested in the next couple of months," the ruler told Martin. "We don't make quarterly earnings announcements. We don't even operate with a midterm horizon of 5 or 10 years. We operate with a lifelong horizon, one generation at a time. In your strategic branding work for my family, if one generation does well, you've accomplished your job." That perspective is vanishingly rare these days. For example, plenty of companies have been caught flat-footed in recent years around social issues, from race relations to marriage equality to climate change. But it usually isn't because their leaders disagree with the premise. As Martin notes, "Through my career, I've come to know hundreds of CEOs, and not one of them, I mean zero, has ever disagreed with the concept of equality." What's driving their awkward responses is often fear of the short-term consequences, whether it's a hit to quarterly earnings, a dip in stock price, or a slashed year-end bonus. It takes courage to be a long-term thinker and a willingness to buck the near-term consequences, but the payoff can be enormous. My friend Jonathan Brill is an innovation expert in Silicon Valley. "The real risk for companies," he told me, "is that you hire smart people who know how to win, and you tell them to win at the wrong thing." When all the incentives point towards short-term revenue goals, that's what executives optimize for. The result of that, Jonathan says, is that you can lose by winning. You lose because instead of investing in meaningful innovation that can transform your company or your industry, you invest in what's known as feature innovation, as in, what color button should I put on that new box? A new color on a box doesn't revolutionize anything, and it won't last. But it's easy, and it might marginally improve outcomes right now. Everyone loves 10x returns and the luster of breakthrough innovation, of course. But the problem is, it takes time. It takes typically 5 or 6 years for a product or a business to get to scale, Jonathan says. There's a ramp-up period to see if things are working, to adjust, and to optimize. For a long time, even some of the best innovations can look like sinkholes where money goes to die. But once they're established, you've built a powerful competitive moat. Ultimately, he says, what you're looking for is profit. That happens on the decade scale. That doesn't happen on the quarterly scale. It's only long-term thinking that will get you there. And it turns out, the same principle that works for the best and smartest corporations also works in our own lives. It was 2008, in the heady weeks before the financial crash. I'd managed to talk my way into an elite conference where I didn't know anyone and was probably the least qualified person in the room. I found a group of people about my age and, victory, cadged an invitation to join them for dinner. They all knew one another because they'd all gone to the same Ivy League college. As we waited for the appetizers to arrive, one woman started a conversation about whether, a decade out of school, people in their class had produced more babies or books. For what seemed like several hours, they ticked through the names of people they all knew. This one had a baby. That one had written a book. This one was expecting. That one had written 5 books. And on and on. Back then, I had 0 babies and 0 books. All I could do was smile pleasantly and think, F you. There's a great quote by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow that goes something like, "We measure ourselves by what we feel capable of doing, while others measure us based on what we've done." This makes sense, of course, but it's awfully frustrating when there's a gap between what we know we can accomplish and what we've done up to that point. Everything takes longer than we want it to. Everything. By the start of the next year, I had a plan. Land a book contract in the coming 12 months, no matter what. I was relentless and spent the spring writing 3 different book proposals. A publisher was going to want one of them, I was sure, but I wasn't going to take any chances. Through a friend, I managed to hook up with a literary agent. She rejected 1 proposal out of the gate. It's an article, not a book, she told me, but thought the other 2 might have merit. Over the summer, I revised them endlessly, polishing my prose and sharpening my ideas until we had something distinct to send to publishers. Except no one wanted them either. Rejection after rejection came streaming in with the same feedback. Good try, but you're not famous enough. My agent eventually gave up and dropped me. I decided to start blogging, which I didn't want to do, so I could eventually get famous enough to be able to write a book. It took an additional 2 years of pitching myself to publications, begging friends for introductions, and enduring a stream of editors who blew me off. But I finally built up enough articles and momentum to land a book deal. And 2 years after that, Reinventing You was finally released. It had been a long time since that humiliating dinner conversation. But finally, I was able to share my ideas with the world. For every success, there are plenty of times when something we wanted or strove for didn't work out. But equally, along the way, there are times worth savoring. Moments when you realize the small steps that felt frustrating and arduous, and maybe even pointless at the time, were the ones that made the difference. The challenge for all of us is an inner one, to keep going when it seems like no one is paying attention or cares, and to believe that eventually the world will catch up. A few years ago, I launched Recognized Expert, an online course and community for talented professionals to learn how to build their platform so they can share their ideas with the world. Every day, I see participants face the same challenges I went through. There are times to celebrate, but also times when the pitch is rejected, the proposal is turned down, or the application to present never even gets a response. Meanwhile, the endless barrage on social media makes it clear everyone else seems to have it figured out. We can't help but wonder, should I be hustling faster, grinding more, crushing it harder? Why isn't it working? For most of us, we're already hustling as hard and as fast as we possibly can. For many professionals, there's literally no margin. We're so caught up in execution mode, it feels like there's barely even time to think. So what can we do? There are two things I hate in this world. One of them is patience. My entire childhood, I resented being told I couldn't drive or open a business or vote. I didn't want to wait for my life to start mattering. But I've made my peace with patience, because everything meaningful I've done has required far more time than I wanted or anticipated. The 5 years between being in that how many books conversation and publishing my first one felt like a shameful eternity. Why was it taking so long? And yet it came, eventually. I've come to understand what few recognize. The rate of payoff for persevering during those dark days isn't linear. It's exponential. It took 5 years on the surface to show any progress at all between that dinner conversation and actually having a book to show for it. But in the half decade after that, I managed to build a 7-figure business, become a professor at 2 of America's top business schools, and have my books translated into 11 languages. I also became a Broadway investor, a stand-up comedian, and a producer of a Grammy-winning jazz album on the side. If it were easy to be patient and easy to do the work, then everyone would do it. What I've come to love about patience is that, ultimately, it's the truest test of merit. Are you willing to do the work despite no guaranteed outcome? We earn our success by toiling without recognition, accolades, or even any certainty that it's going to come to fruition. We have to take it on faith and do it anyway. That's strategic patience. You have to surround yourself with people you admire and trust and learn from their example. You have to study what's worked before and what you wish to emulate and then determine where you want to do something different. And you have to be willing, and so many aren't, to make choices. To recognize that saying yes to one thing inevitably means saying no to something else. You have to weigh those consequences and put your chips on the table. Trying to do it all means nothing of substance will ever get done. But the power of consciously choosing how we're going to spend our time, and therefore our lives, is monumental. You have to place your bets, make your move, and wait. So I've become okay with patience. What I haven't become okay with, the second thing I hate, is information hoarding. So often, the people who have succeeded pull up the ladder behind them. For them, it's better to stick to the conventional heroic narrative. Brilliance and talent got recognized. No need to dirty your hands with tactics or scrap to succeed when you're so exceptional. Except no one is that exceptional. I knew a very successful artist, the kind who spoke at TED and landed major international commissions. I asked her how she broke through. What was her secret? "Just do great work," she said. If only. Great work is necessary, of course, but it's a starting point. You and I all know talented people, just as good as the pros, who never made it. There are always steps, techniques, strategies, but when those who have already made it don't share what they know, no one else really learns what it takes. The process remains shrouded in secrecy. That makes me angry. We all know the mantra, there's no such thing as an overnight success. We know it takes time and patience. But what I've come to discover in my executive coaching work and with participants in my recognized expert community is that it's often unclear what patience means. Is patience writing 2 articles? 10? 100? 1,000? How long until we get our ideas recognized and are able to create the kind of lives and careers we want? In the long game, my goal is to lay the process bare and to share the unvarnished reality behind what it takes to build long-term success. The first step is understanding that the key to a meaningful life is to set our own terms for it. Financial success is certainly something that most of us strive for, but it should never be the only metric. Instead, we need to think broadly about how we want to grow and develop as people and how to interlace those themes into our lives. The other step is understanding that we can attain almost anything we want, but not instantly. If we're methodical, if we're persistent, if we take small, deliberate steps, we can arrive there. The going may be slow at first, but the advantages of those actions compounded over time can lead to stunning results. Playing the long game, eschewing short-term gratification in order to work toward an uncertain but worthy future goal, isn't easy. but it's the surest path to meaningful and lasting success in a world that so often prioritizes what's easy, quick, and ultimately shallow. In this book, I'll be sharing key concepts and strategies that undergird the process of long-term thinking, ones that I've discovered through experimentation in my own life, as well as through coaching hundreds of top executives and entrepreneurs. This book is intended for professionals who want something more out of their lives and work, and who are willing to take the harder path to get there. You may be a mid-career executive, like Jenny, wondering what's next. You could be an entrepreneur, like Ron, frustrated that your ideas aren't being heard as widely as you wish. You could be planning for a retirement career, like Albert, and don't want to waste time or energy with the wrong moves. You might be a younger professional, like Marie, ready to play on a bigger stage. Metaphorical or literal, in Chapter 3, you'll hear about Marie's journey to performing at the legendary Carnegie Hall. The book is divided into three sections: white space, focus where it counts, and keeping the faith. In Section 1, white space, we'll start with an often overlooked part of playing the long game: the need to clear the decks first. If you're too busy and frenzied to think, then it's almost impossible to break out of a short-term mindset. In Chapter 1, we'll talk about the real reason we're all so busy. You have too much to do, it's true. But it's also true that our stuffed calendars tend to be a prison of our own making. We'll discuss practical tools you can use to escape, or at least jam open the bars a little wider. And in Chapter 2, we'll turn to specific ways you can get more comfortable saying no, so that you can create more room in your calendar to do what's most important. Section 2, Focus Where It Counts, gets to the heart of long-term thinking. How do we identify the right goals to go after, and how can we pursue them strategically and effectively, given the other serious demands on our time? In Chapter 3, we'll discuss frameworks you can use to identify the right goals for you, and I'll make the case why you should optimize for interesting. Chapter 4 centers around the concept, popularized by Google, of 20% time, meaning you spend one-fifth of your time on new ideas and projects. I'll share examples of professionals who applied this strategy in their own lives, and why it's important for all of us to set aside time for experimentation. Chapter 5 addresses a common objection: I want to do it all, but I don't know where to start. We'll talk about how to map out your implementation strategy using a concept I call thinking in waves. Chapter 6 is all about getting smarter with how we spend our time. Is there a way to kill two birds with one stone and leverage our time and energy more efficiently to achieve our goals? It turns out there is. The section concludes with Chapter 7, which explains why building a strong network is critical to playing the long game and why so many people hesitate to do it. I'll lay out a framework that can help you think through how to build genuine relationships and not feel sleazy during the networking process. Finally, in Section 3, Keeping the Faith, we'll turn to what is often the hardest part about playing the long game: moving forward despite challenges or setbacks. In Chapter 8, we'll discuss strategic patience, the key to persevering when you've hit a plateau, or even, at times, when it feels like you're slipping backward. Chapter 9 takes on failure, which usually feels awful and humiliating, Silicon Valley's fail-fast ideology notwithstanding. The secret is understanding the crucial difference between failure and experimentation, because if you're learning, you're not actually failing. Finally, in Chapter 10, we'll talk about the final step: reaping the rewards of your hard work. Ironically, that's not always easy for successful people. Over the years, you grow accustomed to striving and hustling, and it can be hard to pull back and actually stop and savor the moment. But playing the long game today means building the kind of long-term career success that enables you to look back with satisfaction and joy at the life you've created. Intellectually, we all know that lasting success takes persistence and effort, and yet so much of our culture pushes us toward doing what's easy, what's guaranteed, and what looks glamorous in the moment. The long game is intended to be a clarion call on behalf of long-term thinking. It's a practical toolkit that shows you, in those darkest moments of doubt, how to keep prioritizing what matters most, doing small things over time to achieve your goals, and being willing to keep at them, even when they seem pointless, boring, or hard. Those are the choices that set you apart. It's blogging when no one reads your blog to test ideas and create an audience. It's taking the Toastmasters class when it seems like no one cares what you have to say to become a more effective presenter. It's going to networking events when you feel like the least accomplished person in the room to gain new insights and contacts. You can't perceive a difference after a week or a month or often even a year. Big goals may seem, and frankly are, impossible in the short term. But what few realize is that with small, methodical steps taken day after day, almost anything is attainable, and frequently sooner than you might imagine. So let's start playing the long game. Section 1. White space. You can't pour more liquid into a glass that's already full. And that's why, if we're going to make smart choices about how to spend our time and energy, we need to give ourselves some white space. Too many talented professionals live their lives on autopilot, racing around from one obligation to another. Being so busy may seem like the path to success, but without time to reflect, an ominous possibility looms. What if we're optimizing for the wrong things? We need to give ourselves the opportunity to explore what a successful life means to us. That's what we cover in the next two chapters. Chapter 1. The real reason we're all so busy. We all know that rushing around and living eternally in the short term isn't optimal. In fact, in a study of senior leaders by the Management Research Group, 97% identified strategic thinking, the ability to focus deliberately on long-term priorities, as key to their organization's success. But something's getting in the way. In a separate study, almost the exact same percentage of respondents, 96%, claimed they don't have enough time to do long-term strategic thinking. Really? There's no question that professionals today are busy. A McKinsey study shows knowledge workers spend a full 28% of their time processing email, and a separate study by the Atlassian Group says that professionals attend an average of 62 meetings per month, which sounds like a shocking number until you realize it breaks down to about 2 or 3 meetings per workday. That's not unusual, that's just Tuesday. The frenzy of scurrying from appointment to appointment, writing report after report, taking an occasional selfie, hi internet, and then answering emails until midnight begins to feel like we're living our own personal Groundhog Day. Meanwhile, our real work, the work we get evaluated on and that actually accomplishes something, is what gets sandwiched in between. The truth is, some firms still erroneously conflate FaceTime at the office, or screen time if you're working virtually, with productivity and company loyalty. Research shows that employees who log 50 or more hours per week earn 6% more compared with their less zealous colleagues, even though productivity actually decreases after 50 hours. So the always-on mentality is a rational adaptation to those misplaced incentives. But that's not the whole story. When 96% of high-achieving leaders say they just can't get around to something mission-critical, something else is going on. The hidden benefits of frenzy. We say we want white space in our calendar and time to think. After all, we constantly feel on the brink of falling behind. We're always looking ahead to the next thing on the calendar and are never able to enjoy what's in front of us. Even the best job becomes miserable if the pace is too frenetic, the demands too overwhelming, and the pressure too unyielding. So why can't we stop? It turns out that we may be deriving hidden benefits from our relentless short-term execution mode. Research from Sylvia Bellezza of Columbia Business School and her colleagues showed that being busy, at least in the United States, signals high social status. Individuals who possess the human capital characteristics that employers or clients value, for example, competence and ambition, are expected to be in high demand and short supply on the job market. Thus, by telling others that we are busy and working all the time, we are implicitly suggesting that we are sought after, which enhances our perceived status. In other words, being crazy busy and making sure others know it may, consciously or subconsciously, be important to our self-esteem. And though we long for the time to do long-term thinking, possessing it may signal we're just a little less essential than we thought we were. Self-worth is certainly a powerful incentive for us to keep busy, but it's not the only one. numbing out.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?